So one of the points that we made in the last year, which was now 2 weeks ago, was an idea that I started developing, and we'll take it a little bit further tonight before we move on, and that was that if we're going to continue to value things in the future the way we valued them in the past, then what I think is a disruption in the whole socioeconomic establishment is one we're going to find very difficult to cope with. So if you remember, we talked about the fact that it is conceivable that employment won't easily reach the same kind of levels in the future as it ever reached, as it was ever in the past. And that even when they talk about unemployment of 8% or 9%, they talk about improvements in employment in the United States. We talked about the fact that many, many of the jobs that are being gained are very part-time jobs. Many of the jobs that are being lost are very full-time jobs. So the net effect is people are working less. And although the statistics measure employment in terms of how many people have jobs, they don't measure it in terms of how many people have jobs that pay a living wage. If you're employed, then you're on the statistic as being employed. But if you start looking at the statistics of full-time work versus part-time work, you realize that Americans are not working. Talking about nationally compared to 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And it's not because they don't want to work. It's because we've outsourced work, and both to technology and to cheaper economies. And we've been doing it consistently over a long period of time. So the types of work that remain are very different. They require very different skills. And one person can now do the work of hundreds. So it's inevitable, and we talked about the fact that we probably haven't yet adjusted to the fact that the world is going to go through such a disruption where work is going to be very difficult to come by. When I talk about work, I'm talking about work as we have known it, a full-time job that pays a living wage. You go to work every Monday, you finish on Friday, and you have a full-time wage, you do it. That's going to become more and more difficult to find. That's not the way the economy is moving. It's different. Work is going to look different, work is going to pay different, and you'll continue to find individuals who do very well, and you'll find individuals who struggle. But generally, if you look at it nationally, the expectation that everybody has a job in terms of the conventional idea is one which we might not see again. I'm saying that as a possibility. It is possible that we might not see that kind of economy again, where everybody has a job. And we talked about the fact that what that requires of us actually is to create a shift in the way we value things. Because if we don't create a shift in the way we value things, then our ability to deal in a different economy that values things in a different way is going to be incredibly tough. And what's interesting is that the way the economy seems to be going requires the types of values that are Torah values more than non-Torah values. That's what's really interesting to me. So in the days, for example, where you needed a six-day job and you could work only in retail, those were the things that people had shops. And the most busy day of the week was Shabbat. And if you didn't work on Shabbos, you couldn't make a living. Remember those days? You read about those days if you don't remember those days. They weren't that long ago. And that's why so many people came from Europe and stopped keeping Shabbos. They couldn't. It wasn't possible. So you had an economy that required a value system different from the Torah. If you followed the Torah's value system, it was hard to make a living. That was the America that your and my grandparents came to, or great-grandparents came to at the beginning of the last century. An America where it was incredibly difficult to make a living as an Orthodox Jew. Today, it's easy to make a living as an Orthodox Jew. There's no sacrifice. You don't have to work on Shabbos. You can get kosher food all over the place. People know who Jews are. There's a respect for Jews. No, there's no sacrifice. There's nothing difficult about earning a living as a Jew. Difficulty earning a living, but not as a Jew anymore. There's no sacrifice required. But I'm saying it goes a step further. And in fact, the kind of values, and here I'm predicting a little bit, I'm visioning a future which may or may not be the case. You need to take your own view. A future is developing that will require even more of a Torah outlook than before. And what do I mean by more of a Torah outlook? In Torah, as we said last time, remember I'm talking about looking at the world from inside Torah rather than looking at Torah from the world. The idea of the lenses that we've been speaking to. The world looks different when you're in Torah and you look out at the world, rather than the secular approach, which is you're in the world and you're looking at Torah from the world. So what we're doing in these sessions is we're trying to look at the world from inside Torah. And if you look at the world from inside Torah, then the Torah value is, if there's any way I could manage to get some free time rather than work, that would be amazing. So a Torah Jew will exchange, I'm talking about rather than work and lie on the beach, I'd say a Torah Jew would exchange a lot of money for free time that he can use to study and to study Torah, to serve Hashem. That's what a Torah Jew would do. And for a lot of money. So he would take, and if you look at the way our ancestors lived, those who certainly are from Lithuania and some other parts of Eastern Europe, that was understood. That was the greatest thing. The greatest value was to be a Talmid Chacham. And we spoke last time about the difference between a Talmid Chacham and an Am Haaretz, and that's how we defined it. An Am Haaretz is a person of the land, of the world, of nature. A person who looks at Torah from a natural, from a secular perspective. A Talmid Chacham is a person who looks at nature and the secular world from a Torah perspective. And certainly in Lithuania and in many parts of Eastern Europe and in many religious homes, even in places like the United States, the greatest value was not for my child to go to university, not for my child to become a professor or a doctor or an accountant or a lawyer. The greatest value was to be a Talmid Chacham, a mechanech, an educator, a rav. That was the greatest value. And everybody knew that meant poverty. And that wasn't a sacrifice. Because the value system in those times, among those people, was the greatest status was for a person who had disposable time, not one who had disposable money. We live in a society where people's status is measured by how much disposable income they've got. So you talked to me about 60 Minutes today with Bill Gates and Warren Buffett giving in the 90th percentile of their wealth to charity. That's status. And now they're on 60 Minutes for doing what? Giving away an enormous amount of money for charitable causes. So what is the cause of that status? They have the disposable income to do that. They don't need that money. They're not cutting their standard of living. Believe me, when an ordinary person takes out of his pocket $18 that he can't afford and he gives it to a poor person, that's much greater tzedakah than 90% of Bill Gates' money going to charity. That's not a question of how much it affects. Sure, what he's doing is amazing. What he's doing for the world is amazing. But in terms of a charitable contribution, when somebody makes a sacrifice and has to say, do I get a meal today? Do I get dinner tonight? Or do I give tzedakah? That's a value choice. And for Jews, looking at the world through Torah, those were the kind of value choices. So you would give away as much of your income earning capability as you could and still survive in order to get free time, because free time was the highest value. Because what can you buy with free time? Olam haba. You can buy eternity with free time. What can you buy with all the money that Bill Gates has got? Only olam hazeh. Yes, by doing tzedakah, you can also do other things. But in terms of the buying power of time is much greater than the buying power of money to a person looking at the world through the Torah. So why would I sacrifice time for money? Why would one do that? I'm looking at the world now from a Torah perspective. When we talk about a Torah Jew, that's what a Torah Jew is. A Torah Jew would never invest time to make money over and above what he needs. He would use his money to get free time, so that with his free time he could invest in Olam Haba, he could have eternity. And not just I'm talking about having eternity, but living a life of eternity, living a life of spirituality, living a life of Avodas Hashem. It's a different kind of a life. That's how a Jew looks at the world. Now, if we all looked at the world, again, theoretically, I'm talking about something that is entirely theoretical, not possible at the moment. But imagine that everybody looked at the world that way. Would there be a job shortage even in this economy? No, because everybody would say, I really only want to work 3 hours a day. That's what I want. I'm happy to live in a very small place and a very small life and to work 3 hours a day so that I have another 19 hours a day to serve Hashem and to develop myself as a spiritual being and to develop my character and to learn more Torah. That's what I want. I'm happy with 3 hours a day. Maybe I can't live on 3 hours. I'll have to take a job for 4 hours. That's a different kind of economy. But you see what I'm saying? When the way we look at the way the economy is going, and if I say to you, it looks as if it might be going in a place where the jobs as we knew them will hardly exist anymore, we think, oh, that's terrible. What's going to happen? Where will my children find work? But if we really had a Torah perspective, what would we be saying? Isn't that incredible? You might be able to earn a living by working 4 hours a day. Do you remember when computers, the whole industry started and internet started? Remember people used to say, what are people going to do with their leisure? There's going to be so much time available. And it hasn't really materialized. Things are just happening faster. We've got less time, not more time. But the only reason we've got less time is because we still want the same standard of living. What we didn't realize 30 years ago when they started with technology and people started saying, there will come a time where there'll be a lot of leisure time. What they really meant is you'll have to take the leisure time because there won't be work. But that also means you won't be earning. It's not you'll be earning as much as you're earning now and you'll have leisure time. That piece they didn't tell us. What they really meant was you'll need fewer people to do what needs to be done to create an economy, which means everybody's going to earn less. But you'll have more time in exchange. And if we would have taken the deal, we would have had more time. If we would have said, that's great, now you can do things with computers. I only need to work 4 hours a day, but I need to take half the income. But that's okay, because that means I can learn Torah for the other half a day. Then we would all be fine. We would be sitting in a wonderful place. But we're not. We want to earn the same as we did before. We want to earn more than we did before. And we want the leisure time. And we want the jobs. And we want everything. Can't be. That's what we're going to have to adjust ourselves to. We can't have it all. And we're going to have to make some value choices. Are we going to look then for jobs that can keep us at our current standard of living? Or are we going to look for jobs that are going to release some time so that we can contract our standard of living and free up some time and have more disposable time rather than disposable income? Because the real status is for people who've got disposable time and they can buy Olam Haba, not people who've got disposable money and they can buy Olam Hazeh. That's the kind of change that we need to go about. And with that, you'll understand the Medrash. The Medrash is a very fascinating Medrash in Parashat Tes of Medrash of Bereshis Rabbah. B'torato shel Rabbi Meir matzu katuv. In Rabbi Meir's Sefer Torah, they found a strange comment. When it says, V'hinei tov ma'od, at the end of the sixth day, when Hashem says, and it was very good, in his Sefer Torah it said, V'hinei tov mos. Instead of tov ma'od, it said tov mot. And that means death is good. And that doesn't mean that the words were changed in the Sefer Torah. They used to use scrolls in those days. That's why it says it's in his Sefer, in his Torah. But Matzah Ketuv, he had it on the margin. He'd made a note. Tov ma'od, read as tov mot. Death is good. Why is death good? What's so good about death? Death is good because death gives value to time. If there was no death, there would be no value to time. Because what is value? Value is when you have to make a choice. Value is when you can't have everything, you would decide. Which do you want? Which are you going to give up? That's what value is. Both moral values and economic values. When you're talking about value, there is no value to something that is an infinite supply. For there to be value, there's got to be a limited supply and higher demand. Then there's value. If there's either no demand or there's limitless supply, there is no value. If there was no death, then time would be in limitless supply. If time was in limitless supply, it would have no value. Says Rabbi Meir, Tov Mot. Death was a gift to the world because it introduced the idea of time is money. The idea that we said last time, that money is time. That the time has a value too. And that one has to use time as the currency, not money. Because money is in less limited supply than time. As we've seen in the last What are we talking about? 6 years, five, 6 years. When the country gets short of money, what does it do? Make some more. If you get short of time, what can you do? No making more. There is no more. That's it. It's finite. And you don't even know how much you've got. Quite a scary thing. There's a finite amount determined by a force other than you. You don't know when it is, and there is not 1 second more. That's what you've got. That's what gives value to time. But if we don't think of it that way, if we think of death as some terrible thing, as some kind of plague in the world, and we don't see it like Rabbi Meir sees it, that death is a finality that gives closure and therefore makes time valuable, and therefore time can become a currency. That's seeing the world through the eyes of Torah, not seeing Torah through the eyes of the world. And interesting along the same lines and tying into the paradox of life, because that's what we've been talking about in the series, is this paradox that the human being has to live and has to manage, and everywhere it's paradox, and the tension between the paradox, and that creates the energy of human life. That you need polarity. You've only got energy when there's movement between poles. Take one pole away, there's no energy. And so everything is with polarity. Life and death are two poles that give value to time. If there was no life, time would have no value. If life was eternal, there would be no value. You need life and you need death. You need people to live between that pole of birth and death, and that gives time. That gives value to time. But then you've got to live with that paradox. You've got to be able to see that and understand it and feel the passage of time. Like when we were talking outside, I reckon we were talking about how we are. You kind of almost complainingly said, you know, we're getting older also. It's a reality. It's something you're in touch with. That's something we're moving, we're growing, we're evolving. It's not forever. We've got stuff we need to get done in this life. That's what makes it valuable. That's what gives it energy. If it was eternal, we wouldn't have that value. The other paradox, also in the Tov Ma'od, in the Medrash a little bit further on, it says, Hinei Tov Ma'od Zeh Yetzer Tov, Vehinei Tov Ma'od Zeh Yetzer Hara. That this Tov Ma'od, Hinei Tov Ma'od, Vehinei, not only, but Vehinei Tov Ma'od, says the Medrash, it's extremely good, which he didn't say on the other days. What's so extremely good? Rabbi Meir says that death was introduced, and although we don't actually see death until after the Chet, but the concept of death was created. God didn't create the concept of death after Adam sinned, because he said, if you eat from the tree, you will die. So death was created before. Death was created on the sixth day, the ability, the potential for death. And the other thing is the two Yetzarim, Yetzar Tov and Yetzar Hara. And we talked about those two operating systems. Again, polarities. You've got the survival instinct in the human being, and you've got the creative drive in the human being. They're two different poles. What enables a person to do something heroic, like to take that $18 out of their pocket and say, I won't have dinner tonight, I want to give charity, and I can't do both. It's interesting. We don't even think that way. It's not that often that we have those kind of choices in our lives. Maybe when we want to make big purchases or big investments, but on a day-to-day, we don't have that. I remember as a child, my father showing me in among his sforim, this sefer, this book, I had to go without a meal for 2 weeks in order to be able to buy this sefer. This sefer I was able to get very cheaply. I only had to sacrifice two or three meals, and I was able to afford this sefer. That's how these books sat in his library as value choices. They weren't just books that you just go onto Amazon and click with one click, it's delivered to your door the next day. We don't make value choices. And the whole economy is built on, you don't have to make a value choice, just go online, press click, and it'll be delivered. No value choice. You don't go through the thought of, that means I can't do something else, and what that something else could be. So when a person takes money out of his pocket that he could use for himself or his family, and decides to do an act of tzedakah with that money, that's a heroic act. That's an act. That's a creative act. That's not putting yourself first. That's putting yourself second. That's Yetzer Tov. When a person focuses on his own comfort and his own immediate needs, that's Yetzer Hara. We used to thinking of Yetzer Hara as kind of this evil inclination, and Yetzer Tov as doing mitzvahs. No, Yetzer Tov is survival. Yetzer Hara is survival, And we need it, as you'll see in a moment. It's not a bad thing. It's called Yetzer Hara, and we'll see why. And Yetzer HaTov is doing things for others, making a difference in the world. When you're making a difference in the world at your own expense, that's Yetzer HaTov. When you're taking care of yourself and not making a difference to the world because it costs you too much in energy or effort or time or money, that's Yetzer Hara. That's all it is. And the strangest thing is, and that's all the work of Viktor Frankl, that the more you forget yourself and engage in making a difference, the better it is for you as an individual, even physically. That was the incredible discovery of Viktor Frankl, that even in the concentration camps, it was the people who did chesed who survived, not the people who looked after themselves. That's how the human being is created, looking after yourself. I'm not talking about not being careless and all. Of course, you can't be careless with matters of health. You've got to, in that sense, you've got to look after yourself. But to be focused on your own well-being and your own self-actualization and your own happiness and your own health to the exclusion of the people around you, that doesn't do any good for your health and happiness. The time that health and happiness really progresses is when the focus is on others. And that was the really important discovery that he made in the concentration camps. And for decades afterwards, he was criticized by scientists as that not being possible, it not being scientific. And his response was, "You said possible or not, scientific or not, I saw it. I studied it." And the Medrash says, why is Yetzer Hara Tov, and Yetzer Hara Tov is Tov? V'chi Yetzer Hara Tov Ma'od, asks the Medrash. How can you say such a thing? Is Yetzer Hara so good? Who would say such a thing? If it weren't for the Yetzer Hara, people wouldn't build homes. V'lo nasa isha, they wouldn't get married. V'lo holid, they wouldn't have children. V'lo nasa v'natan, they wouldn't build businesses. So the Yetzer Hara is not evil. It's not about evil. The Yetzer Hara is simply something that is focused on self-preservation, and it's ra compared to tov. It can become bad. Not that it is inherently bad. Hashem created it. Why would it be inherently bad? Just as death isn't inherently bad. Rabbi Meir says it's tov mod. It's very good. Death is a good thing. It doesn't mean we want it, but it's a good thing to have in the world. The world would not be a better place if there wasn't death. It would be a worse place. And so it is with Yetzer Hara. The world would not be a better place if there wasn't Yetzer Hara. It would be a worse place. Because it's Yetzer Hara, it's the survival instinct. Survival instinct is what drives us to procreate, to have families, to build businesses, to build buildings, cities, towns, countries. That's all because of Yetzer Hara. Now, of course, as that goes wild and we start stealing and robbing and murdering and killing and battling in war for these things we've built, that's when it becomes Yetzer Hara. It's out of control. But inherently, we need, that's the paradox we live with. There needs to be Yetzer Tov, there needs to be Yetzer Hara, and the human being is this being who manages it in the middle, who manages that kind of tension all the way through. And if you look in your Chumash, you'll actually see this whole idea hinted in the spelling of a word. If you look in your Chumash in chapter 2, verse 7. Chapter 2, verse 7, Perek Beit, Pasuk Zayin. Vayitzer Hashem Elokim et Ha'adam. And Hashem Elokim, sorry?
Page 10.
Vayitzer Hashem Elokim et Ha'adam. And Hashem Elokim formed man, afar min ha'adama, from dust of the earth. Vayipach ba'apav nishmat chayim. And he breathed into him a breath of life. Look at that word, Vayitzer. How many yuds? Two. Look at verse 19, a little further, where you see the same word, Vayitzer. How many yuds?
One.
What's the difference in context with the Vayitzer in verse 19 and the Vayitzer in verse 2, in verse 7?
Animals
in 19, humans in 7. Says the Baal HaTurim, because humans have two Yetzarim. Humans are built with two operating systems. Animals are built with instinct, that's all. They only have instinct, there's no polarity. They aren't the two yuds. And look, it's yud, both of them Hashem's word. So the Yetzer HaTov and Yetzer HaRa, both of them are yuds. And the human, they're powers. Yetzer HaTov is a power, it's a force. Yetzer HaRa is a force. And the human being has to manage these two opposite forces all the time. That's what we do. Animals don't have it. By Yitzhak, it's one. And you'll remember we said that not all human beings have it either. That human beings have to make a choice as to whether they want to have that idea of a yirdu, and rule over the earth. Well, it depends who you are. If you're somebody who's developed spiritual capacity, then you rule. Otherwise, it's raid. You become degenerate in the world. And you see that also in these verses here, because if you look at that verse 7, an amazing posuk. This is like the introduction of the human being into the world and into the Torah. Although at the end of chapter 1, we're already introduced to the creation of man. But here, the story is really told in detail. So, Vayitzer Hashem forms this multifaceted human being with these two poles of energy, Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Ra, an element of humanness and an element of divinity in the same being. Afar min ha'adamah, he makes him with dust from the earth. So he uses nature, he uses silicon to make him. He just uses sand as one of the parts to make him. And then, vayipach bi'apav nishmat chayim. And God then breathes into him a breath of life. And the Zohar says, the Ramban brings it also, man de nafach mitocho nafach. When somebody breathes, they breathe from deep inside themselves. Where does your breath come from? It comes from deep inside you. So when it says Hashem breathed into Adam, what did he breathe? Where was that breath coming from? It was deep, a deep source of divine force was breathed into this being made of earth, this natural being of an animal-like form. And we talked about the original Ramban and that the form could have been one that evolved. It was an animal-like form into which Hashem breathes from his very essence. So now the man is an animal with the essence of God breathed into him. What a being, what a concept. Vayehi ha'adam, and then man came, l'nefesh chaya, a living soul. And says Unculus, what is a living soul? What does that mean? Can you see, if you, those of you who can read the Unculus, the Aramaic translation on the side, at the end of verse 7, Zion, Unafach ba'apoy nishmetad chaye, and Hashem breathed into him a breath of life, v'havat ba'adam l'ruach memalala, and man became a speaking being. That's what a living force is. Now you remember we talked 2 weeks ago, and in the earlier shiurim, that what the Tzelem Elokim, what is it that distinguishes it? What is the image of God? It's lahavinu lahaskil, our ability to extrapolate, to think, to reason, to innovate. That's what's godly about us. That's the Tzelem Elokim. And that's what we've got to develop and we've got to perfect. And here we see that the method of doing that is with Ruach Mamalala, the ability to speak. Because if you can't speak, you can't conceptualize. If you can't speak, you can't attach a name to an object. And so your only way of dealing with objects is with the real object. You can't deal with them as concepts. And in your mind, when you're thinking in language. You're not thinking in real things. You might see the images, but when you're thinking, the relationships are created in language. Without language, it's not a matter of communicating with one another. Animals can communicate with each other. They say dolphins can speak to each other and elephants can communicate with each other. There's some very clever animals who can communicate. Ruach mamalala doesn't mean speak to one another, doesn't mean communicate. Ruach mamalala means I can use words to conceptualize. I can create ideas. The only way you can create ideas is if you have access to language. And that's what a human being can do. Lahavinu lahaskil, the image of God is we can create ideas. That's all we can create. We can't create things. We can form things, but we can't create things. There's nothing new. And chadash tachat hashemesh, there's nothing new we can create. We can turn energy into matter. We can turn matter into energy. That's about as creative as we can get. But we can create ideas. And with those ideas, we can apply the world in different ways. And we can work the world in different ways. But what we've created is an idea. But to create an idea, you need language. You need to be a ruach mamalala, speaking being. So now the power of speech becomes the tool of divinity. So think of the tool of divinity. If I were to say to you, apart from the power of speech, if I say to you, what is the tool of divinity? What would you say? What comes to mind? What is the tool of divinity? So without speech. What is the tool of divinity? If we hadn't had the shiur, if I just said, what do you think is the tool? What are the tools you use to access divinity?
Prayer. Silent
prayer.
Prayer? Creation,
yeah. How about what's in there? The Torah is our tool for divinity. That's how we access Hashem. That's a tool for divinity. How do we treat it? How do we treat the Torah? When the ark opens up, what do? Stand up. When the Torah is being read, what are we supposed to be doing? Keep quiet. Listening. Covered. That's what we do with the Torah. Speech is a tool of divinity. That's how we should be treating speech. And before you approach the Torah, what do? You wash your hands. In some shuls, you've got to be dressed properly. You won't get an aliyah if you're not dressed properly. Make sure you're dressed properly. Make sure that your hands are clean. Your mind is clear. You go up with a lot of emo and yiro, with a lot of awe and seriousness. That's how you approach the Torah. And speech? That's what speech is. Ruach Mamala comes from Hashem himself. That is the divine spirit. It's the way we access Hashem. And we need to treat our speech and other people's speech with the same level of sanctity that we deal with the Torah itself. That's what speech is in the human being. We start to get an idea of who this human being is, what this is. You've got to kind of think of the world before man walks into it. There's a world, there's all of nature. Everything in nature is in place. The whole planet in all its beauty and its spectacular glory is all in place. And then Adam walks in. Who is Adam? This master of paradox. This a person with the ability to manage these powerful forces of the divine and the natural. And to be able to work with instinct and with the creative force. And Ruach Mamalala, the ability to create ideas all the time. Every time a word comes out of your mouth, you're creating an idea. Every time you string a few words together to make a sentence, you're creating an idea. Certainly when you really get into the area of being very creative with thought. That's what the human being is. We can create ideas. Ruach Mamalala. But the Kleyaka learns, your friend, the Kleyaka learns this pasuk a little differently. And he says, you know, this word Nefesh Chaya, Rashi tries to figure his way out of it, but the Kleyaka says not very successfully. If you look at Rashi, those of you who can read the Rashi, at the end of Pasuk Zayin, La Nefesh Chaya, Af Behema V'Chaya Nikru Nefesh Chaya, what an anticlimax, says Rashi. Look, we're just talking about an incredible being, a human being. And what do we call him? A Nefesh Chaya. What did we use? We used that phrase before already. For animals, for fish, for insects. Nefesh Chaya. Is that what the human being is? No, says Rashi. Arzu shel Adam chaya shebekulan. But this one is this chaya, this animal, this life force is superior to all of them. Shenitvasef bo deya v'dibur. Because he has intellect and speech. That's what differentiates it. Yes, he's an animal. You look at it and science says, you know, we're sophisticated animals, says Rashi, but make no mistake. Very sophisticated. Because we have Deya V'Dibur, that's what makes us different. But says the Kleyaka, but then why use the word Nefesh Chaya? If we're such a unique species, if we're so different, if we're so powerful, why use the word Nefesh Chaya? Look how the Kleyaka reads the Pasuk. He says, Vayipach Be'apav Nishmat Chayim. Yes, God breathes into man this divine soul. Absolutely. Adam, but man, even at that point, is nothing more than a nefesh chaya, than an animal. It's now up to you whether you're going to take that nefesh, that nishmat chayim, and you're going to work it and refine it and grow it and nurture it. Because if you don't, you're a nefesh chaya. That's all you are. You're not born a human being. You're not made a human being. You've got to make yourself a human being. You're born a nefesh chaya. You're born an animal that can speak, a talking animal, a thinking animal. That's what you're born. Now turn the thinking animal into a human being who's a creative force that can access the divine, that can access God. That depends on you. That's not something you were given. That's not something you were created with. So once again, we see the paradox. Are we an animal or are we angel? We're both. And who does it depend on which one we become on ourselves? Does every human being have an image of God? No, we've already established that. I know that's not politically correct. We like to believe everybody's created in the image of God. Maybe created. Not, we don't stay that way. But the Kleioka goes even further and says, we're not even created that way. We're created with the potential to become the image of God. That's what we're created with. That you can say, all men are equal in that we're all given the potential to become godly images. But whether or not we choose to develop that potential is our own choice. Nobody else determines that. We choose whether we have Tzelem Elohim. We choose whether or not we're going to become we're going to develop this Nishmas Chaim, and whether we're going to become this divine human being. And so if we go a little bit further into the Medrash now, and we get even deeper understanding into this being, have a look at this. So isn't it different when you learn the Chumash with Medrash? If you learn the Chumash without the Medrash, you've got the same book that the Christians have got and the Buddhists have got and everybody's got. It's the book, the Bible. It's not going to tell us a whole lot. It's the Medrash. When you start learning the Chumash with the Chazal, with the Medrash, and you understand the Jewish, the Torah. Torah is not the Bible. So here says the Medrash the following, in Parsha Yud Dalet. Vayitzer, two Yuds. The Medrash also, like the Baal HaTurim, notices that there are two Yuds. Shtei Yitzirot, Yitzira min HaTachtonim, Yitzira min HaElyonim. So here it's slightly different take. This is not two Yitzarim, this is not the Yetzer HaTov and the Yetzer HaRa. This is about higher forces and lower forces. Paradox again, still these two forces, we're managing polarity. Rabbi Yeshua bar Nechemiah b'shem Rabbi Chanina bar Yitzchak v'Rabbanan b'shem Rabbi Eliezer b'shem Rabbi Eliezer say Barabo Dalet Briot Milamala v'Dalet Milamata. Hashem introduces four dimensions into man that are primarily natural, and four that are primarily divine. Which are they? Ochel v'shoteke behema. We eat and we drink like animals. We're no different to animals. So the way we eat and we drink, that's animal. Poroverova kibehema, we procreate like animals. We have sexual relations, we have children. Matil glolim kibehema, we relieve ourselves like animals. Umeit kibehema, we die like animals. So the normal life cycle, that's all from the animals. Milamala, what are the things we have that come from the higher force? Look at the first one. Omed, kamalach ha'ashoris. We stand. We don't walk around on all fours. That's divine. One of the divine features. So what makes us divine? That we can, as Rashi said, lahavinu lahaskil, our intellectual ability, dea v'dibur, our ability to create ideas and to articulate and to speak, our ability to stand upright. That's why we say in the morning, Zokef Kufufim. We thank God when we get out of bed and we can stand on 2 feet and we can stand upright. That's divine. That's not animal. That's not natural. Natural is for these two. And the scientists tell us all the time, our bodies aren't built to stand upright. That's why we get back problems and all sorts of things. We would be more comfortable. Is that right? It would be more natural for us to walk on all fours. It's counterintuitive that we stand on our 2 feet. We're not built, we're not designed that way. Physically, we're not designed that way, but spiritually, we are. Standing upright is part of paradox. It's wrong. It's not the way we're built, but it's the way we stand. Medaber, we speak. Divine. Umevin, we understand. Veroeh, and we can see. Now, look at this. What is the question? Yeah, big deal. See, I understand. Stand upright. Good. We can speak. I understand. We have havona. We have intellect. Understand. But roe, animals can see too. Says the Medrash. Vahema eno roe isma. Are you out of your mind? Can animals not see? Answer the Gemara. Elo ze metzadet. They can see, but they've got to turn their heads to see. We don't have to. We can look straight, and we have a wide field of vision. We can see what's happening on the sides.
The opposite.
Well, says the Medrash, it's not the opposite.
The animals have the privilege. They got their eyes on the side. We're the ones who look at them.
But you see, if they want to look at you, they've got to turn. They can't. They don't have peripheral vision, apparently, says the Medrash. I can only tell you what the Medrash says. They have to turn their heads. They can't see. They don't have wide vision. They have to turn their heads. It looks like it because their eyes are on the side. You think that they would see.
Yes.
But then they can't see in front of them, maybe. They can only see on the side. I don't know. It's very hard to know how animals see and what animals see. But, says the Medrash, they need to turn their heads. If they want to get clear vision for something, they need to turn their heads. We can look straight ahead and we can get a much wider scale of vision. Why is that divine? Why is that so important? That's what I want to know. The others are all very clear. Why is it so important? So it's not just vision. And it's not the quality of the vision, it's the fact that we don't have to turn our heads to see. What does that give us the capacity for? For?
Focus.
Great. Focus. We can stay focused. And what is the power of that focus? If I remember, once or twice I tried to play golf and I gave it up as soon as I realized that God certainly didn't create me for that purpose because I didn't have a great deal of talent. So why waste your time doing something God didn't create you to do? You kind of discover quite quickly what he didn't create you to do. But I remember them telling me, those of you who do play golf can tell me if that's right, keep your eye on where you want the ball to go. Is that right?
Yeah.
Keep your eye and don't move it. Focus. Because the ball will go where your eye is. Now what does that mean? That's incredible. By putting your eye, by attaching your eye to something, you're fixing a destination. And if the ball follows your eye, the ball is not connected to you in any way, if the ball is going to follow your eye for 200 or 300 or 400 feet or more, what about you following your eye? Absolutely. That's the power of focus. You can go where you put your eye. Now you'll understand one or two more things. Look at this statement. A little bit further in the Chumash. God makes the Garden of Eden and he plants all sorts of trees and there's a river there. And we're told, look at verse 6. Verse 5, let's go further back to verse 5 in chapter 2. V'chol siach hasadeh terem yeh va'aretz. And all, just before you could see all the greenery of the earth. V'chol esev hasadeh terem yitzvach. And before the grasses began to grow. They were ready to grow. The Chazal tell us they were at the edge of the surface of the earth, ready to sprout. But the earth was still brown at that time. You couldn't see the green. Why? Ki lo himtir Hashem Elokim al ha'aretz, because Hashem had not yet brought rain. Va'adam ayin la'avodet ha'adama, and there was not yet, the reason he didn't bring rain is because there was no man yet. We'll discuss that in a moment. Va'ed yaleh min ha'aretz v'ishkat kol apnei ha'adama. At that time, there was a kind of a cloud, water vapor came up from the earth, and that's what watered the earth and got the plants ready to come out. But they hadn't actually started sprouting and growing because there hadn't yet been rain. Says the Medrash, God actually, so to say, changes his mind and decides first that the earth will water itself from below and then decides that rain will come from above. And the Medrash actually asks why the change. And says, Mipnei Dalud Dvarim Chazar Bo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in Parshat Yud Gimel in the Medrash Rabbah, for four reasons, Hashem reversed his decision. Shelo Tehei Haaretz Shoteh Ela Milamala, that the earth should get its nourishment, its water, only from the top, not from rivers. Originally, there were going to be rivers that were going to be supplied from water that the earth would produce from springs. There would be no need for rain. And then God introduces rain into the earth. Why? Gives the four reasons. And the fourth reason is, Sheyehu ha'kol tolim enehem klapei mala. So that people will look upwards to see the clouds, to wonder whether it's going to rain or not. Why is that important? For that reason, all the science of rainfall is so that people will look upwards when they want to know if it's going to rain or not. Why? Why is looking upwards important? Where you focus your eyes, where your mind goes. Where you focus your eyes, where your ball goes when you're playing golf, when you're playing Torah, where you focus your eye is where your mind goes. And the human being can stand upright. Why? So that he can look up. He can look forward, and he can look up. An animal can't look up. It's very difficult for an animal to look up. An animal can look down or can look straight with difficulty. It's about as far as it can get. But it can't look up and look at the sky and see the stars and look at the clouds and see whether it's going to rain or not. Why is that so important? That angle is important. Because when you're looking up, the whole angle changes. You know, they say, and I'm just going on what they say, that almost every time there's a presidential election in America, the taller man wins. And that's quite interesting. I don't know why they go to the expense of having elections. They should just pick the taller man and save us all the trouble. Looking up to somebody has a certain something to it. The stature, physical stature, just looking upwards is different from looking downwards. You're at an advantage. And people use that advantage in negotiations, and you sit higher than the other person, that they've got to look up at you, and now you've got you're at a disadvantage when you're looking up. You're at an advantage when you're looking down. What does Hashem want the human being to be? In what situation? I'm not the tallest person. When I'm talking to Hashem, I look up. Because that angle changes my mindset. That angle changes the way I feel. That angle changes the way I relate to the world. And so Hashem wants rain to come from the sky so that people will look up to look for rain, not look down. Where have we had another case of this in the Torah?
Amalek,
why? With the hands up and with the hands up and down, a good one. And where else? In Parshas Chukat, you remember the snakes, the plague of the snakes, and they made a copper snake on a pole. And Rashi brings the Yerushalmi. V'chi nachash meimito mechaye. Does a copper snake decide whether you're going to live or die? No. Ela bizman shehayu Yisrael mistaklim klapei mala. When the Jews looked upwards, because there was that snake on the pole. U'meshabdim et libam la'avim shebashamayim. And they subject their hearts to Hashem in heaven. Hayu mitrapim, they were healed. So we've got to understand that that where we look is important. Where we gaze is important. To be able to look ahead, to be able to focus ahead, and not have to turn from side to side, to be able to be focused, is an amazing gift. Because with focus you can vision, and with vision you can accomplish. But if we keep on getting distracted and we look all over the place, and what has our mobile technology done to us? It removed the divinity of our capacity to vision. That's how serious it is. Because we're constantly distracted. We become like animals. Mitzadidim. The phone rings, we look this way. The computer rings, we look that way. Phone rings again, we look that way. There's a text message, we look that way. We're like animals. We've lost the human capacity to remain focused. That's where I'm going. Nothing else is important. I can see the rest. I don't have to look at it. I can see what's happening. Whatever I need to see, I can see. That's a human capability. And the ability to look upwards and to think of the Ribbono Shel Olam as a force that is higher, not a force that is equal or a force that is lower, but to think of the Ribbono Shel Olam as a force that is higher, that becomes incredibly important. So when we look at this amazing being, this Odom, we see is an Odom that has the ability, lahavinu laskil, to think, to contemplate, to intellectualize. That's the Odom. That he has the ability to have deo v'dibur. He can conceptualize, he can create ideas using speech. That is Odom. He can make new ideas, he can formulate new ideas, he can articulate new ideas. That's an Odom. That we have these two parts. We have aspects of ourselves which are divine and aspects of ourselves which are animal. And we need them both. To survive, to thrive, to operate in the world, we need them both. And they're opposite, and we're using that opposite, we're managing that opposite. That's an Odom. The fact that we have the ability to develop and cultivate our own Tzelem Elohim, that we can make ourselves in the image of God. Hashem gave us the potential. He didn't make us in His image, He gave us the tools to make ourselves in His image. The fact that we can do that, we can make ourselves into godly images. That's Adam, that's the human being. That's how great the human being is. The fact that the human being can focus, that he doesn't have to look from side to side, he can choose something in the future and work towards it without distraction. That's an Adam. The fact that the human being can look to Shamayim and understand his dependency on Hashem, on a force that is higher than him, as great as he is as a human being, he's lower than Hashem, he's below Hashem, he's dependent on Hashem, to be able to understand that paradox. I rule the world, but I'm ruled by God. And I live in that paradox, I live between those poles of ruling and being ruled. That's the Adam, that's the human being. And that's why when Adam is introduced here in chapter 2, he's referred to several times, not as Adam, but as Ha-Adam, the Adam. That's a different being. This is not just man. This is the Adam. This is the human being, the ultimate of God's creation and the purpose for which he made it. Thank you.